Initiate countdown.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Welcome to the March and Drive-In Podcast number 2. My name is Terry Frost. And this time around, we're going to be talking about a couple of films you might not know about that are a lot of fun. And I have a guest, Rob Jan from Zero G on 3RRR Radio. And Rob and I had a lovely little chat just earlier, and we're going to play that for you soon. But I'll get the how to contact me stuff out of the way. Best way is either you can go to Facebook and look up Paleo Cinema. So if you do facebook.com/paleocinema, one word. You can email on cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. I also have a brand new voicemail number because the old one was destroyed due to lack of use, which I'll lay a good trip on everybody about that a little bit later. But the new voicemail number, he said, waiting for the stupid thing to load on the computer is... Okay, I've got it now because the computer went slow on me. It's area code 206-203-3299. So use that one again, 206-203-3299. So, yeah, I got a lot of interesting response from the first Martian Drive-In podcast. I didn't get a lot of feedback in the sense of structured feedback, but a lot of people liked it. A lot of people mentioned it to me, but nothing I can really put into a feedback thing. But, so that was... I think I'm going to continue with it. I really enjoy it. I like the difference between that and Paleo Cinema. I do like playing both sides of the fence there. And I like the fact that this particular podcast is going to have guests from now on. And I really enjoyed the hell out of talking with Rob. So what have I been doing lately? Mad Men Video, who are one of the great purveyors of anime and cult movies and foreign language film videos here in Australia, they're moving their warehouse from the old location in Collingwood, I think it is, or Collingwood / Fitzroy. And a couple of weekends ago, they had an enormous garage sale, so they didn't have to carry everything to their new warehouse. So I went down there on the Saturday morning and picked up some interesting things. I could have picked up a lot more, but A, I didn't have the money, and B, there was only me, so I could only carry so much. And what I ended up with was pretty good. I got a big poster of the video released of Jules Dassin's Rafifi, a framed poster and a good frame, for $10. And the thing is, you know, it's about... 600 centimetres wide and about a metre tall, so it's not an inconsiderable poster. I've got it sitting here because I haven't found a wall to put it on yet. So I got that for $10. I got a box set of 4 Douglas Sirk films. They're French releases, but you can take out the subtitles with the menu. So I got all the 4 classic Douglas Sirk films for like $5 on DVD. I got F for Fake, an original copy of F for Fake, for $5. I got the Jean Cocteau Beauty and the Beast for $5 on DVD. And I got a box set of all the Tintin animated adventures from the 1960s for about $20 all up, including a really cool backpack, a Mad Men Video backpack. All up, I spent $65 and got a ton of stuff. The place was packed. The queue, I'm not kidding, was 300 or 400 meters long when I got there. And there were a lot of interesting things that people were buying, a lot of tons and tons of anime. And I'm not that into anime, but I can appreciate that there were a lot of otaku in Melbourne who were. And I got in there, got out fast, and went home to gloat over my possessions. So I did that. Not much else been doing around here. Taking things a little bit easy. Did a few farmers markets, and my vegetable patch is going particularly well at the moment. Got some broccoli coming up, spring onions. We've got some cauliflower that's going to go soon. Tons and tons of parsley and other nice veggie things. I think the best way for me to eat vegetables, and I'm not that keen on cooked vegetables, to be honest with you, but the best way to get me to eat vegetables is to let me grow them. If I grow them, I'll eat them. So the more green and healthy things I grow, the more healthy I'll get. So I'm enjoying that again, that sticking tiny things in the ground and having large edible things grow from them is quite a rewarding thing. So I won't go into what I've been watching particularly at the moment because I haven't got the list up, but I'll talk about that next fortnight in Paleo Cinema. I do have a little bit of feedback. What I'm going to do with the feedback is I won't keep the feedback specifically for the podcast. So whatever feedback I get after 2 weeks, I'll put it at the end of whichever podcast I happen to be doing that fortnight. So as a lot of people will know, one fortnight it's Paleo Cinema, one fortnight it is the Martian Drive-In podcast. So the feedback will just continue onwards, so people will get the quicker response and the feedback.
Here's the breaking news from the planet Mars.
Okay, so what has been happening in, around, and toward the planet Mars? Basically, they're going to do the Italian job on Mars. Now, when I say the Italian job, I'm exaggerating a little bit. So they're not going to have Cockneys driving around grabbing money from Italian armored cars. There's nothing like that. But then in August, a new lander is going to hit Mars, hopefully very softly. It's a rover called Curiosity, and it's the same size as a Mini Cooper. So basically it's going to be an Italian job sized Martian rover. It's got six wheels, it weighs 900 kilos, and it's got a grabbing arm that can reach up to two stories high, so it can pick pockets on the upstairs window. So it's going to be, let me have a look at the size of it. It's 10 foot long, 3 meters long, and it's got 176 pounds or 80 kilos of scientific instruments included. So it's big enough to ride on if you were up there to ride on it. What it's going to be doing is determining whether Mars could ever have supported life, study the climate of Mars, study the geology of Mars, plan for a human mission to Mars. And they're going to determine the mineralogical composition of the Martian surface and near-surface geological materials. They're going to try to detect the building blocks of life, interpret the processes that are formed in modified rocks and soils, assess the long timescale Martian atmospheric evolution to see what the atmosphere used to be like, determine the present state, distribution, and cycling of water and carbon dioxide on Mars, characterize the broad spectrum of surface radiation, including galactic radiation, cosmic radiation, solar proton events, and secondary neutrons. And on its way there, it's also going to do a radiation count and function in lieu of an astronaut, just to see how much radiation an astronaut would take on a trip to Mars. So it's doing pretty much a lot of stuff. It'll probably do a few donuts and burnouts as well while it's there at some stage, but that's the next thing. It's the largest thing that mobile thing we've ever landed on Mars, and it looks kind of cool. It's got that weird stripped down NASA look with lots of little instruments and things off it. It's got six fat tires and a big arm on the front of it. It looks a little bit Lego, a little bit Meccano, but I think it's going to be interesting. We're going to get some good stuff out of it. It's also radioactive. It runs on a radioisotope power system. It's got 32 pellets of plutonium dioxide, plutonium-238 dioxide. They're each about the size of a marshmallow. So that's pretty cool too. Basically, it's got two computers on board with about a total of 4 gig of flash memory on them. So that's going to be it. I'm going to look forward to this. The rover looks really cool. It's much bigger. It's much more complicated than anything human beings have chucked up onto Mars previously. And with a bit of luck, it'll vindicate John Carter. So that's about the only news from Mars, and just mentioning space news as well. SpaceX Dragon went up to the International Space Station, dropped off the groceries, and came back again. Good on it, the private enterprise hitting it, because governments are too busy spending their money on wars and stopping people from legally getting abortions and all sorts of other weird and horrible things that governments do. And it's nice to see that all the money that we throw into buying electronic gadgets is actually going to do some good in the universe by getting people out there and starting the private exploration of space, because governments just can't be fucked doing it. I'm going to take a little break now, and when I get back, I'm going to be having a chat with Rob Jan about two films, one from 1967, which I have done in Paleo Cinema very, very early on, but I wanted to revisit it, is Peter Watkins' 1967 film Privilege, and also a 2009 film, see, it's different from Paleo Cinema, 2009 film directed by an English director, Christopher Smith, and it's Triangle, starring Melissa George. And don't let the fact that an Australian soap opera actress stars in it. This film has a lot to go for it, and Rob and I will discuss that very, very soon.
Do you enjoy movies like Carnival of Souls, The Mole People, Black Sunday, and The Tingler? Do you find yourself late at night reading magazines such as Film Max, Chiller Theater, or Monster Bash? Do you love vintage television programs like Sky King, Outer Limits, and The Time Tunnel? Do you find yourself surfing the net looking for the next Monster Movie Festival or Expo? Do you enjoy hearing anecdotes, cinematic details, and unusual insights into some of your favorite movies? If you answered yes to any of the above, you're encouraged to join your host, Vince Rotolo, as he examines some of the latest horror, sci-fi, and cult theatrical releases, new DVDs to add to your collection, and of course, the old classics, both good and bad. He even interviews people throughout B-Moviedom. So tune into B-MovieCast at bmoviecast.com.
Resistance is futile.
That's just a reminder for people to send me any podcast promos as well. I'm going to be doing another podcast promo before the end of the podcast. If you have any, send them to kultguru@gmail.com. And unless they're promoting religion or pedophilia, I will play them on the podcast. So I'll just get in and do the Rob Jan stuff and get the recording up and running that Rob and I completed about half an hour ago, and let you understand and experience the wonderfulness of what he has to say. And as I promised everybody, we have a guest for the second Martian Drive-In podcast. It's Rob Jan, who, in the my way of looking, was podcasting before podcasts existed. How are you, Rob?
Oh, I'm fine and dandy. How are you, Terry?
Oh, yeah, breezing along with the breeze, man. So you do Zero G on 3RRR Community Radio. When did you start that?
Oh, back in 1994.
So you've been doing it for like 18 years now.
Yeah, something like that, since before the turn of the century.
How'd you get involved with that?
Oh, that's a fairly complicated story, but the short, it's like being a werewolf. The short answer is I got bit.
Okay.
No, it was Paula Ruzek, who used to be in the Austrek Star Trek Club. We got together and we thought, well, why don't somebody do a science fiction show on Triple R? Because I'd listened to all sorts of shows as I was growing up on Triple R.
Yeah. And there were things like Danger Lowbrow at that time and all those kind of cult movie shows.
Yes, indeed.
And I used to listen to those when I first came to Melbourne back in the early 90s. And then you came along and started doing Zero G, and it took off from there.
It did.
Mm. So you've interviewed some very famous people, mate. You really kind of got the creme de la creme. Remember Derek Jacobi? You interviewed him at one stage.
Yeah, that was fun. He was in a hotel room in Tasmania on tour on a rainy Sunday afternoon, much like this one.
Yeah, it's not too good out there, is it? But anybody else that was really memorable that you've interviewed during the years at Zero G?
Well, you know, after a while, like, you sort of realize everybody puts on their pants one leg at a time, generally, with the people. So you sort of lose that sort of, oh, that fanboy feeling, unless you're dealing with Joss Whedon.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, you did deal with Joss Whedon, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I don't know if I dealt with him, but he actually directed me. I brought my camera along and I said, let's get a shot of us looking in the hotel mirror. So he took the camera off me and then gave it back and he said, right, okay, I'm going to direct you. So directed by Joss Whedon.
There you go. Well before Robert Downey Jr.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Zero-G, yeah, it's fantastic stuff. So basically it's science fiction, fantasy. You're still doing the historical as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I know you're a big history fan.
Well, the thing is that I look at it as, just different worlds either way. It's either in the future or off-world or it's in the past. It's still strange.
Yeah, and that's it. Things that aren't of here and now, kind of.
And you're into the past and strange and curious too, Terry.
Well, yeah, with the paleo cinema and that kind of thing, and a number of other bits and pieces around the place. And we did a little bit of this yesterday. I love running around junk shops and finding old things.
Yes, exactly.
So there's all of that. Yeah, and well, thank you for Zero-G and for the time you put into it. And it's well worth people checking out. You're still podcasting it. It's still coming up on iTunes, is it?
Yes, we podcast, and we're also doing radio on demand as well, so you can listen in at any stage at rrr.org.au.
I thought I'd give you the opportunity for the plug. But when you're talking about you getting used to things, I mean, I've got that radio gear I'm doing for ABC once a week.
Yes.
And when you go into a little booth called a TARDIS, which is just a recording booth attached to the room where all the mixers and everything are. And before I go in, somebody usually comes out. And half the time it's somebody really famous. And you just kind of get used to this fact that they're going to come out. I mean, we get federal senators and all sorts of people wandering in and out of there, and you just go, okay, they're heading out.
I thought you said famous, not infamous.
Well, it was Sarah Hanson-Young, so it's famous rather than infamous. And she's a Green senator here in Australia, for people that don't know, and nice set of legs for a politician too, I've got to admit. But anyway, I should let people know the two movies we're talking about. We're doing Peter Watkins' 1967 science fiction movie Privilege, starring Paul Jones and Gene Shrimpton. And we're doing a 2009 movie, which is probably the most recent film I've ever done on a podcast, which is Triangle, starring Melissa George. And it's quite an interesting little time paradox movie that a lot of people haven't heard about. Yeah, getting on to Privilege, did you notice the Doctor Who references in Privilege?
Yeah, there was a few of them in there. It felt like it was very bedded into the pop culture of the 60s anyway, so I guess that would have to include Doctor Who.
I've got a better one for you than that. You ready for this? The chick that played Amy Pond in Doctor Who, Karen Gillan,
yeah,
is playing Gene Shrimpton in a TV movie.
Strangely enough, I knew that.
And the other thing is that Paul Jones, the star of the movie, his real last name is Pond.
Ah, now that, I didn't know. That's cool.
I'm glad I got some trivia you didn't know, because you are up on your stuff, man.
Did you know that he actually goes on in real life to become a bit of an evangelist and a Christian speaker?
He is, and I know recently he's done some stuff on BBC Radio 4 as well. But given the arc of the movie, I'm a bit surprised he got bitten by that particular bug.
Yeah, well, I mean, his wife was, so, you know.
I got sucked into it. But anyway, I'll play the trailer for Privilege now, and you've got to just accept the bombast of a 1960s movie trailer. And when we get back, we'll get into the plot line and talking about what we think about it.
Slate 1, take 1. Privilege. Slate 1, take 1. The start of a new experience in the cinema. Privilege. A new insight on a new kind of idol.
I'm a person.
Stephen Shorter, pop singer. He's not so much a person as a puppet whose strings are pulled for a scheme of total nightmare. Privilege is a terrifying and withering expose of the misuse of power in an age of illusion.
I need my freedom, not your sympathy.
Starring Paul Jones, one of Britain's top pop entertainers, as Stephen Shorter. His first motion picture, your first chance to share this exciting event.
Set me free. Set me free.
Gene Shrimpton, international favorite. The face on every major magazine cover the world over.
I've been a bag.
Now the girl with the most beautiful face makes her sensational debut on the cinema screen to give a portrait at once unconventional and memorable.
My parents have got this place in the country and they're away at the moment, and I think we should go there.
like everybody. You wake up and find me. We want something, I mean, it's obvious what you want, isn't it?
Privilege, a John Heyman, Peter Watkins production. Directed by Academy Award winner Peter Watkins.
All right, the director's a plain nut.
Peter Watkins, this explosive new talent, first hit the headlines when the BBC banned his highly controversial film, The War Game. Now he assails the big screen as he blows the lid off the pop music world. And we can't wait to hear the uproar.
Fall on their knees, his arms are stretching to you and me.
Privilege, the film that points the way to rebels with a cause. A scathing drama about organized nightmare. The motion picture that says what others dare not even think.
Okay, there you go. An over-the-top 1960s-style trailer. Obviously, there was an American voiceover on that, so it's not the English one. But anyway, it gives you a little bit of an idea about the movie. So the movie's about – it's set in the near future of 1967, which we've got to assume early 70s. A guy called Steve Shorter is the most popular pop star in the world, and he's being used by a coalition government in the UK, a coalition of the Conservatives and Labour, to manipulate the population and keep them sedated. So the Wikipedia plot summary says the story is set in the then near future of the 1970s and concerns a disillusioned pop singer who, manipulated by the church and state, which seeks to turn him into a messianic leader, and he, in a very small way, rebels against that. So, Rob, what do you reckon?
Well, it is a very small rebellion at the end, isn't it? It's, you know, the moment when he rebels against the system that's manipulating him is given by a small line of dialogue. He's at a kind of a dinner party and he just says, I would prefer to have some hot chocolate. It's a very small thing.
And then at the end where he says, I hate you all. And that's the extent of this guy's rebellion. But because they've created this kind of bubble around him where he's there to make people buy British products and to help out with an apple glut that they're having. So everybody's got to eat 6 apples a day for the rest of summer. Otherwise, the apple crop's going to be thrown away. And then, of course, they decide to amp it up a little bit from there and use him to manipulate the people on a very overt and quite fascistic manner.
It is very fascist, that whole British fascism thing. And, of course, they're referencing Triumph of the Will all the way through, especially at the big pep rally that they have.
Yeah, where they get the churches involved and they use him to as a figurehead for the churches. And that that priest they have there as their figurehead, very Hitlerian. I mean, the way he talks and the cadences and just the tone is very like Hitler. But we'll start at the start of things a little bit, where it kind of starts out a little bit lighter, where they're talking about him being the most popular pop star in the world, and they're doing the first ticker tape parade in the history of England for Steve Shorter. And you can tell right at the start that the character is on his way to a breakdown. He's not happy. He's kind of shriveled in upon himself. And the whole act he has is about somebody who's being imprisoned by authority.
He's very passive, isn't he, really, Jones? As an actor, he hasn't done too much else in that way, because he actually was a singer and he's had quite a few albums and president of the Harmonica Society or something.
He liked a good organ in his mouth. But I shouldn't say that, but I think he is. He was in Man from Man's band for a while.
And
I've actually got the soundtrack album for this. I picked it up while I was overseas, and I've got all of the, you know, their pop version of Onward Christian Soldiers, which is very kind of Jerry and the Pacemakers sounding.
Yeah, Barry. What's his name? James Bond composer.
John Barry.
That's right, John Barry. Yeah. Used to do a lot of that stuff around the same time too. But Mark London, the one of the soundtrack guys on this, he did To Sir With Love as well. So you've got this whole swinging 60s thing going there with the dystopia overlaid on top of it.
It is, and that's the thing. I think one of the things Watkins did really well in this is he looked at the pop culture and the fact that the 60s Britpop whole thing was a working class thing. It was four guys from Liverpool. It was little bands from Birmingham and down south and all sorts of places like that, but they were overwhelmingly working class. And I think what he's done there is, well, what would the aristocracy and the people higher up in class in England do to manipulate this?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's presaging all of the manufactured bands and creating celebrities as brands in themselves.
Mm. Yeah, I was reading a little bit about that, particularly the Monkees, which were the first real kind of manipulated and created band. And there are a whole bunch of very subtle bits of rebellion in the lyrics of it. Like The Last Train to Clarksville, I was reading, is actually an anti-Vietnam screed.
Well, yeah, Peter Watkins is all very pacifist, and but he's also, he's funny. He's a funny pacifist. He's a militant pacifist. And I think it's interesting that in this film that although he's a big proponent of pacifism, in this case he's actually against pacification of people.
Yeah, and I think that Paul Jones character, Steve Shorter, is his idea of the pacifist that doesn't take any action. He only rebels when he becomes stressed, rather than when it's right to rebel. There are any number of points along the movie where a reasonable person who maybe, you know, had their act together would have protested or would have moved things in a different direction, would have realized the power that he actually does hold.
Well, it's interesting, the nominal love interest in the film, and it's a very sort of washed out, sort of pallid love affair. Jean Shrimpton, who's the actress playing the character of Vanessa, she's commissioned to paint his portrait. And she sort of swans in with a mini skirt and all that sort of stuff and big doe eyes and eyelashes and that whole swinging 60s sort of it girl thing. And then she manipulates him essentially. So we don't really know if that rebellion that he has near the end of the film is actually his own thought or whether he's just being manipulated yet again.
Yeah, whether he's a puppet for two different lots of people, Gene Shrimpton's character and the authorities as well. And there's a really interesting premise in this that there's a collaboration between corporations. Of course, Steve Shorter Enterprises is a big business run from the top end of town, and the church and the government. So you've got all three power bodies in the English society all working through this one guy and using him as a conduit.
Yes, and he's very uncomfortable in his little jacket with his SS symbols on the collar.
It's for Steve Shorter ostensibly, but I'm pretty sure that the initials were deliberately chosen that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the Nazi imagery has been co-opted for this film, and there was one that particularly struck me. There's a poster on the wall behind him at some stage, and it's got a broad arrow with his face on it, you know, property of Her Majesty's government.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The whole symbolism they use for him is the arrows they have on prison suits, those kind of wide arrows so people even at a distance could see an escaping prisoner, those kind of things. But there are odd little moments of comedy too with his record producer, Uncle Julie, who's an old Jewish vaudevillian guy who keeps trying to put inappropriate songs into the minds of the other people in the creative process.
Oh, yeah, and he's actually the composer for the soundtrack.
Yeah. Is it him? No, Mark London's actually the younger guy,
Okay.
Yeah, Alvin. I'm going to find out who that guy is because I'm just going to flip the page here. Mark London was Alvin. Max Bacon played Uncle Julie.
Yeah.
Yeah, the kind of old, bald Jewish guy with a cigar who runs the business. And there are a couple of little implications with how many records he sold. So Alvin thinks it's 1,400,000, and Julie says it's 1,200,000. So obviously he's scraping a little bit off the side.
It's all very Monty Python-esque, isn't it?
It is a little bit. And I think that's a nice, subtle thing that Watkins does. He has those little bits of comedy, so you're not just inflicted with the ramping up tension that Steve Shorter is experiencing and the ways that he's being manipulated. You have those little kind of light notes to balance that. Otherwise, it would be quite a depressing movie, and it's not really. It's an interesting one.
Are we supposed to have the same catharsis as the audience?
I'm not sure. I think that where they have the first concert where he's in the big cell on stage and the coppers beat him and all sorts of things like that, you see that kind of sexual hysteria that girls had during the 1960s over pop stars and probably still do to a certain extent. I'm not sure what Justin Bieber concerts are like. But yeah, you get that really, you know, channeling of energy into really weird places in this movie.
Yeah, well, I think you're spot on there with the sort of up and down motion of it in terms of they have those lighter moments. They played John Philip Sousa's march, the Liberty Bell, the Monty Python film, during the rally.
Yeah, I think it predates Monty Python, though, which is interesting. Maybe Monty Python got it from watching Privilege.
Yeah.
which would be an interesting little side note.
Well, speaking of side notes, how's this one? Paul Jones, who plays Stephen Shorter, he did an environmental British television show called The Uncle Jack Show, and he was the hero in that. And the villain was Fenella M. Feldman, who played the voice of the village announcer in The Prisoner.
Oh, nice. So there was an Uncle Jack, and then we had an Auntie Jack.
Indeed.
Yeah. It was quite the opposite of Uncle Jack from the.
Hey, maybe you're right. Maybe there's all these sort of influences that come out of Privilege that nobody knows about.
Yeah, I think people who were art students in the 60s would have seen this film. You know, it would have been shown on 16mm projectors in church halls somewhere in Australia and other places like that. So the influences are there, and particularly after the two previous things that Watkins did, Culloden, where they did a version of the Battle of Culloden and the War Game. I think it really brought him to certain people's attention, particularly the people that wanted something a little bit more than Petula Clark and Tommy Steele movies.
Well, of course, you couldn't actually see the War Game on television until the 80s, but you could see it at private screenings, which they had a lot of.
Yeah, it was. It's a very dark little piece of work, that one, and I think that one of the things to the credit of Watkins is he didn't pull his punches where he saw something that needed to be said. He didn't soft code it particularly.
He went on to do Punishment Park, which is kind of similar to The Hunger Games too, with its hippies being hunted down by soldiers in the desert.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you've got Battle Royale, which is similar to The Hunger Games as well. That's kind of like a Disney-fied version of Battle Royale in a way.
Yeah. Although I think I actually like The Hunger Games, so I'm not going to pay out on it.
haven't caught it yet, but I've heard enough about it to go, yeah, what it really needed was to, you know, beat Takeshi throwing a knife into someone's head right at the start.
I think they probably would have had that influence on them, because I've reviewed Battle Royale 1 and 2 recently, and there's a lot of similarities there.
There is, and that's unfortunate. My theory, which I've mentioned in the podcast before a number of times, is go to the original source. Doesn't matter if you like the secondary things, go to the original source, because it'll either enhance what you see in the things that are influenced by it, or it'll teach you a little bit more about what good cinema is.
Well, hey, you know, we've got that mantra, it ain't Twilight.
Yes, but on the other hand, that's like saying it ain't, yeah, you've got cancer, but on the other hand, it ain't Ebola.
Yeah, no, look, I seriously did like The Hunger Games, and these sort of films, we know they go in cycles and they come back, and maybe they hadn't seen, you know, I mean, the author may not have seen any of those films. She said she hadn't.
Yes, but you wouldn't really admit it, would you?
No, but, you know, well, I suppose the conspiracy could be there.
Well, I'm not sure it's particularly a conspiracy. I think it's just using publicity to your own ends, and people do say things they don't mean in that, because if they you know, any tiny little misstatement may create a big controversy.
Yeah, well, that brings us back to Privilege, because there are a lot of people who comment in the background in that film, and a lot of those are unreliable commentators, which Peter Watkins loves to have in his film.
Yeah, the corporate guys, there's only one bit of truth talking by the guy who runs Stephen Shorter Enterprises, and that's where he takes him up on top of the building and tells him that all those little people out there don't matter. We've got to control them, because they don't think very well, and they're not smart, and they need to be controlled, otherwise it'll be pure anarchy.
Just like the character of Stephen Shorter himself, everything's disconnected between the action on the screen and the background stuff, the dialogue that they've got in there. And that sort of out-of-universe narrator as well, which is another typical Peter Watkins device.
Yeah, which is a lovely piece. It's very kind of detached and cold, a lot like a lot of the social documentaries that were in England at the time. It's very much got that documentary feel about it.
Mm. I love that line. 61 people in the room with Stephen Shorter, of whom 54 have nothing to do with his act. The rest are professional leaners.
Yeah, yeah. They just turned up at the right places. But I mean, there's even things like the music arranger, who's this kind of angry working class guy who. Everything he talks about, he'll start out calmly and they get really impassionately angry about what's going on, but in the end he's co-opted by the process and does the music arranging and things for this enormous Christian fascist rally they have at the end of the film.
Yeah, it's also over the top there, but it's necessary, I think, for the black comedy that we're talking about. You need that in there.
You do, and in a sense it is a black comedy too. It's like, what if the government took over the Beatles, kind of thing.
the Wiggles.
Or what if Paul McCartney ran the Beatles?
Yeah.
Hey,
we should mention Johnny Speight, one of the screenwriters for this, because speaking of class and everything, because he was the creator of that Olympic class bigot, Alf Garnett.
Yeah, To Death Do Us Part, which then went on to have an American iteration in All in the Family.
Yeah.
And he was really into the class warfare thing, which is now becoming another meme here in Australia with the current political climate, where people are going, "Oh, don't play the class warfare card," and half of the people listening go, "Well, why not?"
Important side note here: Johnny Speight's son Richard was Peter in the British sci-fi series The Tomorrow People.
Okay, I haven't seen that for a very long time, but I remember some very bad special effects.
A lot of fascism in The Tomorrow People.
Oh, there's a lot of fascism, a lot of children's television.
They're telepaths, you know.
Yeah.
Now, speaking about fascism and dystopia, 1960s dystopic films.
Yeah, there are a number of them. Let's think. Of course, you've got to go back to the grandfather of dystopia, George Orwell, Eric Blair.
Yeah.
I mean, and they did two versions of 1984 in the 1950s, one for television with Peter Cushing in it, and one for movies with Edmund O'Brien in it. And the thing you get from the dystopias of the 1960s in cinema is people were fucking scared of their children.
Yes, Village of the Damned.
Village of the Damned. You got Village of the Damned. You got Village of the Giants.
Yes.
You've got that one. What was it Wild in the Streets, where everybody over 30 is put into a concentration camp and fed LSD?
Well, that's actually the film that I'm reminded of most when I think of Privilege.
Yeah, it's got the same thing, and it came out a few years after. So again, it may well have been influenced by Privilege, because I do think it, in its own way, even though people don't name check it a lot, it is a very influential film, and it's really. An interesting thing, because the American version with Christopher Jones in it, Hal Holbrook was in it, Shelley Winters was in it playing Christopher Jones' mother. It was done by, I think, American International Pictures. And they, even though they did do a lot of driving kind of films and things like that, the people who ran it did know their cinema pretty well.
Barry Sheer coincidence, that is, the director.
Ooh. I knew you would pun somewhere along the line, man, but
have to do that. Now what about Lindsay Anderson's If from 1968?
Yeah, we've got Lindsay Anderson's If, very much influential as well, with Malcolm McDowell, who went on to have a great career playing various kinds of nutter.
And geez, you're right, they're very scared of their kids, like not Village of the Damned, but not Children of the Damned, but The Damned, that Joseph Losey film from 1961.
Yeah, fantastic film too. I know that there are a couple of podcasts out that specialize in Hammer and Amicus films, particularly Amicus and a couple of other ones, and they really love that film because it brings a whole bunch of things together. It brings that fear of young hooligans, fear of your own children, the atomic fear of the time, the fear of government secrecy. There are all these different things that come into the 1960s. And again, they come into modern things as well. I mean, you have a look at TV series like Person of Interest and Fringe. You've got a number of different fears, contemporary fears we have, which are being played together to make interesting fiction.
It certainly does relate to Privilege, the Damned film, because there's also a sense that, okay, we can ride out the nuclear holocaust by manipulating our children, by changing them so that they become accustomed to radiation. And I feel that in Privilege too, that, okay, we've got this tiger by the tail, but we can make it work.
Yeah, they really do think that they can do it. And I'm not too sure how long-term successful they'd be with that. But one of the interesting things that's different from nowadays that this movie has in it is people in the 1960s were not anywhere near as media savvy as they are now, even young people. Young people now really know how to manipulate media rather than be manipulated by it. But in the 60s, because you had limited outlets apart from the pirate radio stations, everything was pretty much controlled by the government in the UK as far as media was concerned, or by large businesses which had links to government. So it was a lot easier when there were no other inputs coming in to manipulate people in this kind of a way.
Maybe we're manipulating right back now with podcasts and Facebook and social media.
Absolutely, and Twitter particularly. Twitter is very powerful. I mean, look at a TV show like Q&A, which I've been on 5 times now with a tweet about, and three of those tweets were directly in response to something that somebody in government had said on the show. And my tweet was up there underneath the person's face while they were talking.
It gives you a whole new meaning to the term man in the tweet, doesn't it?
Ooh. Yes, it does. But it's a really interesting phenomenon, the fact that you can have a chorus of comment underlining literally what people in power are saying these days. And in this movie, there's nothing at all like that. They hold all the aces.
Well, if I were working on a science fiction script, I'd be thinking about people who ultimately become such media phenomena that they are able to track their tweets, their approval ratings, their hits and likes as they walk around constantly, and their media minders are manipulating that what they're doing by the flow of that. Like people are saying, if you go to that rally right now, you will get a huge upswing in your popularity. So there I go.
I think there's a certain amount of that. I mean, particularly people who do data mining from Twitter. I mean, that's becoming a very big business where people are looking at what's trending on Twitter and what potentially could be trending, and how can we make what we want to say trend on Twitter.
So privilege actually is fairly prophetic, fairly successfully prophetic.
It very much is. I mean, look this way. There were any if you go to any, say, Republican rally now, in America, it's an election year over there, and you've got the Republican rallies, they're going to get as many celebrities and as many right-wing pop stars. There are a few.
Republican rally. Let's nod and say we did.
Yes, okay. But you know what I mean? They do co-opt celebrity into the political process and then complain when a celebrity actually has a political opinion that's contrary to what they like.
Yeah. That's tricky.
It is, yeah. Let's get celebrities to go to our thing, out of benefits, so we can make lots of money. But if they dare talk out of turn, we're going to slap them down.
Well, that's what happens to Stephen Shorter. He gets the Ministry of History erases him.
They literally erase him, and all that's left is a couple of minutes of black and white scratchy footage with no audio on it. They obliterate him, apart from the fact that there's probably millions of old records out there. They obliterate him from history because he dared to, even in a small and really rather pathetic way, talk out of turn.
Yeah, it is actually quite an amazing film, and I've heard of it before, but I'd never actually seen it, so thank you for putting me onto it.
No, that's what the whole thing about. I want to avoid big films when I do the podcast, particularly now I'm doing this second podcast about science fiction and fantasy. I want to avoid the stuff everybody knows as much as I can and point out the cool stuff they might not know for that very reason, because I'm going to be getting a guest on each time, and I want to give the guest something they haven't seen if I can, and then also give the audience things that they might be able to latch on to that are really interesting.
Well, you're doing good work, and the interesting thing also is that these films are now available.
They're ubiquitous almost. There are things that are really good, which I would love to have a decent DVD release on, but all that are available on some of these things are people who have digitized old VHS tapes, and the people who own the rights are just not doing anything with them.
Well, I'd never seen The Damned until I saw it on ABC2 late night once on the digital channel.
Mm.
So they've just got this big voracious appetite and showing us all the great stuff.
Oh, ABC's always been like that. I mean, they were showing things like Dead of Night in the middle of the night when they did two or three movies streaming overnight after the commercial channels long stopped doing that.
Yeah.
And just the choices. And Saturday nights on ABC 2, they're showing classic cinema as well. I'll talk about a movie with Ivor on the ABC Darwin thing, and a month later the movie will turn up on ABC 2. I don't know whether they're listening in or not. But it's a nice coincidence if it isn't. Chances are it is a coincidence. So Ivor keeps stirring me and says they're listening to us.
I could get the same sort of effect. You know how you were talking about the TARDIS recording booths at the ABC? Quite often I'll have a guest on Zero G who's doing the rounds, doing the traps. So he'll be on like John Fane's show or maybe any of the other ones that come on at the same time. So I sort of feel like I'm getting this echo effect.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the people who say something different in each of those different venues and the ones that say the same thing in each of the different venues. There's an interesting split there.
I pretty much guarantee that they're going to say something different on Zero G.
Well, yeah, once you throw a couple of puns at them and throw in, oh, yes, but you were in that children's show in 1972 in the background, weren't you? That's going to take them on a different path.
It's not really big noting it there, but the fact that because I'm not doing this like full time, that allows me to put as much time as I need to into the research.
Yeah, which is a lovely thing about what you do. And listen, to be honest with you, I see you as a role model for what I do in some ways. I listen to Zero G. I don't dip into it as often as I'd like to, but I thought, okay, I want to do stuff like that, but I'd do that a bit differently. But you've definitely been an influence on what I do, which is why I wanted to get you on.
Oh, thank you kindly.
No, it's the truth, mate, so there's no harm in saying that. But, Privilege, I think we both recommend it highly.
Yeah, if I had to give it a rating on my yeah, nah, maybe scale, I'd give it a definite yeah.
Absolutely, and I do like the people going back into the history of cinema, even though this isn't paleo cinema now, it's the Marshall Drive-In podcast. I do like going into there and saying to people, here's where a lot of the stuff you've seen all your life has come from.
Mm.
But yeah, I recommend it highly too. I actually reviewed it very, very early, about 5 years ago in Paleo Cinema when it first came out. But I wanted to get somebody else in to talk about it when I'm starting this new venture because I think it doesn't hurt to revisit it.
And you need validation too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I need constant validation. That's why I'm on Twitter and Facebook. But yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I think that people should see this one. There is a British Film Institute DVD of this if people want to get it legitimately, and if you're not, don't tell me about it publicly. Privilege, highly recommended, as are indeed Peter Watkins' other films. Anything you find by this guy is going to be watchable and thought-provoking.
And he's still in there punching too. He's still writing books about the mono form and the media. And
yeah, he lived in Australia for a time, I've heard.
He lived everywhere.
Yeah, he's a bit of a wanderer. I'm not too sure anybody's going to give him money to make a large feature film or anything like that. But I think in genre cinema, he is an important name, more so than a lot of people who are hyped a lot more than he is.
Well, even more so in history. That War Game telemovie film, that was such a big influence on the anti-nuclear movement back in the 1980s that he's actually a part of history with that. And, you know, The Day After and Threads and other movies that span off of that, that may have changed history. We don't know for sure.
Well, you can't tell really, but you can say that it contributed at least, and that's the very least you could say about it.
Yeah, so we owe him.
Yeah, we do owe him, even though Paul Jones went on to become a religious nut.
Oh, they're collateral damage. All I can say is, Peter Watkins, it is a privilege.
Ooh, I knew you would bend on a pun. But anyway, we'll take a break now, and when we come back, we'll talk about Triangle from 2009.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're back, and Rob and I are now going to talk about a 2009 film filmed in Australia with a British director, and it's Triangle from 2009. I'll just play the trailer, and then we'll get stuck into having a bit of a chat about it.
You know what I do when I have a bad dream? I close my eyes, and I think of something nice.
So let's go sailing.
Wind's dropped out on us.
Get below deck now. Get the life jacket.
Oh, thank God. Hello? Where is everybody?
You enter a place you have never been.
I recognize this corridor.
Everything you see, you have seen before.
That's what's going on. Everything that happened to you before. He's dead! Change the pattern. You changed the pattern and you're not trapped. Who are you?
So, I'll do the plot, and then Rob and I will have a chat. Jess, played by Melissa George, is a single mother to an autistic child, Tommy. Encouraged by her friend Greg to take some time for herself, she joins him and his friends on a day of sailing. They're doing a three-hour tour. Soon they get caught in a freak electrical storm which capsizes their boat, forcing them to seek refuge on a passing ocean liner. Once on board, they realize the ship is empty. Jess, however, feels that she's been there before, and then they start getting hunted by a mysterious assailant. So, Rob, have you seen Time Crimes, Chrono Criminalis?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's got some similarities to that, but apparently the director of the film, Christopher Smith, who's done a couple of interesting genre films, came up with the idea at the Cannes Film Festival in 2004 after seeing Memento. And he mentioned a few other movies that were influential on him. Dead of Night, the kind of omnibus movie from 1948, with these, because it's got a circular time line in it, and a few other things. Are The Shining was a big influence on it, so I think that there are some parallels, but I don't think there was copying from one to the other.
I don't know, maybe all these temporal loop films are all being repeated.
Maybe they're all being made by the same people who are going back in time.
I think they also lift a little bit from La Jetée, you know, there's a bit of that in there too.
Yeah, there are. I mean, the guy's very knowledgeable. I looked at the extras on the Blu-ray that I've got of this, and there are some real nice influences. The guy knows his film, and they did. They, I think, it had about a $12 million budget, and they built the set on a kind of breakwater in Queensland.
Oh yeah, to get the horizon, the sea horizon.
To get the horizon, yeah. They basically built it onto this rocky jetty kind of thing, La Jetée.
Yes.
Where they filmed a lot of it, and they did a little bit on some ships and some other bits, and there's some work in a tank for the storm scenes where the boat capsizes. But in general, I think they did really well. They had the budget wasn't enormous for what they were trying to achieve, and they had things like they couldn't get pneumatic things to rock the boat, so they end up getting blocks and tackles and people pulling on ropes to rock the boat during the storm scenes.
They used the Australian method.
They did brute force.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things is Melissa George, who's basically in every scene in the movie, is a fine actress. She started out doing soap operas and that, and really didn't have too much chops, but then she's developed as an actress over time, and she really sells this one.
Yeah, she goes all Sarah Connor on everyone, doesn't she?
She does a bit, but I like the fact that the protagonist in this kind of a film isn't a guy. It's a single mother with an autistic child, and there are great reasons why that works, and it all rolls into the arc of the film. And there are a couple of nice reverses in the film.
It's very much the cliche now, the butt-kicking chick, and that's what she becomes.
Yeah, I think she does, but she doesn't become a lot of the butt-kicking chicks you see around become the invulnerable butt-kicking chick, and she doesn't suddenly develop kung fu chops or anything like that.
It's less less common to see a butt-kicking chick who starts kicking her own butt in the film.
Well, yeah, we don't want to do too many spoilers. But once she gets on the boat, we can give this away because it's in the trailer
almost, yeah.
She gets into a time loop where there are multiple versions of herself roaming around the ship, and they've had different experiences on the ship, and there are different levels of knowledge about what's actually going on and how to get out of it, which is the important thing, because her child is waiting for her, and her whole motivation is to get back to her child.
The wheels within wheels, different levels of knowledge. It's kind of ironic because she was in Dark City.
Yeah, and I think she got a kid off in Dark City as well. Mm. Yeah.
Did you know, now, this is, I found this out just today, that Melissa George is also the CEO of a group called Style Snaps, which are these little things that you can use to raise or lower your hemlines without sewing. So she's got all this stuff going on outside of acting.
Well, you with your costuming experience would probably use those at some stage.
No, I'd just use a rivet gun.
Yeah, you're more pop rivets than anything on that.
But yeah, no, I thought she did really, really well in this film. And Liam Hemsworth's in there too, who was in The Hunger Games as Gale Hawthorne.
Yeah, the brother of Thor.
Yeah, Thor's little brother.
Thor's little brother with the worst haircut. But, yeah, that's a really interesting film. I like the fact I went into it kind of – somebody told me to check it out somewhere on the web, and I went and checked it out, and I didn't know the plot.
Mm.
So I came in it pretty much the way you did, which is nice and a nice change for me because I usually look at things beforehand. And you've got the shipwreck, and they find this enormous ocean liner with nobody on it called Aeolus, who was the father of Sisyphus.
That's right.
Which has got to be a real indication that things are going to go totally tits up on it.
And also because of Sisyphus pushing the boulder uphill forever, it's going to go repeatedly tits up.
That's it. There's nothing but up tits. But I think they came into it, and suddenly they're on this ship, and what's the mystery of the ship? Is it another ghost ship? You saw a ghost ship from about 2004 with Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah,
where at the start they got the beautiful Italian chick singing Sansafina, and everybody gets massacred 2 seconds later.
Well, I mean, you know that it's like a sailing ship, and there's going to be problems. It's like, you know, Dead Calm and Donkey Punch, and just never get on the boat.
Yeah, I mean, things have changed since Captain Steubing, haven't they? But so they're on the ship, and then suddenly you get the first indication that there's more than one Jess on the ship. And they do a beautiful bit that takes them into the first time loop she experiences, where the camera zooms in while she's looking into a mirror and zooms into the mirror and out as she goes looking, and then suddenly discovers that she sees the upturned yacht coming back at the ship again with all of the people she was on there with, including herself, on that boat.
Well, it's so much, it's so much presaging in this film. Like she's driving along the beach, and there's a sign saying, "Come back to Queensland" or whatever it is. Florida. Sunshine.
Yeah, come back to the Sunshine State, and they crossed out the bit that says Queensland
because it's supposed to be set off the coast of Florida. You know, Miami is the sort of feeling that they got.
Yeah, and the movie's name's Triangle. The yacht they're on is Triangle, of course, and it also indicates the Bermuda Triangle.
Well, yeah, Miami is the home port of the Aeolus, and it's one of the vertices of the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing. They don't necessarily blast that at you. It's just there as the title of the film, and they kind of pan past the name on the hull of the boat. So it's not thrown at people that, oh, geez, this is a Bermuda Triangle thing.
No, it's very lightly touched there. You'd hardly know it was, in the same sort of genre.
I don't think it's that important for people to know that either, but there are some beautiful little grace note parts of this when you realise that the shit's hit the fan worse than that, where Jess drops her locket down a grate in the ship and bends down to try to get it, and finds there are about 30 or 40 other lockets down there identical to the one she's just dropped.
Yeah, these things about these recursive time loops, things tend to pile up, don't they?
They'd be great for selling stuff on eBay.
The references to The Shining, I mean, yeah, you know, we got the number 237 and the Overlook hotel room. And I was just thinking that what is an ocean liner but a floating hotel room?
Yeah, it's a floating hotel come casino, come entertainment venue. It's a bit like Village Knox on the boat, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And there's actors and words on mirrors and all sorts of stuff.
And there's a lot of things on the boat that you can hurt people with.
Yes. Strangely enough, they generally lock them away on real boats, but never mind. How come this boat, this ocean liner, has an entire gun cabinet of shotguns?
I don't know. Maybe they do skeet shooting.
Yeah, that did occur to me. And maybe anti-pirate measures or something.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not going on any cruises off the coast of Somalia soon.
No. couple of other things apart from Sisyphus and The Shining. Yep. There's a big influence from Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner poem.
Yeah. Instead of an albatross, they have a seagull, and the seagull's in there from right at the start. If you have a look in Jess's house before she leaves the thing, you can see a picture on the wall which has got a ship and a seagull in it.
Yeah.
So they've thought this out really well. The plotting was meticulously done.
Do we call this a science fiction film or a fantasy film? We don't have an actual mechanism for the time loop.
Well, there are indications that it could be that her autistic son has certain abilities that this kind of film give to autistic people to compensate for the fact that they are autistic.
Oh, yes.
But there's that is a possibility. There's the ship itself. There's the cab driver that drives her to the dock.
Mm.
There's some indications that he may have something to do.
Feels because more he like says, a fantasy, though, doesn't it?
It does feel a bit like a fantasy, but it's kind of like toss a coin or take your chances on what you think it is. But I think that whatever it is, it works as a narrative, and it works as a horror film at some levels. It works as a personal drama as well, because Jess does, and this isn't a spoiler again, get off the boat, and we find out more about her when she gets off the boat.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice touch, the way they revolved that back.
They did, and that's the lovely thing about it. It's got that third act where other films would have just left it, or maybe done a little bit of a Charlton Heston looking up at the Statue of Liberty kind of bit. But they don't do that. They take it to a different level.
You know, it reminds me a lot of an even lower budget film, Primer from 2004.
Yeah, Primer. And the director, Christopher Smith, did mention Primer as one of the influences as well. He said that as he was coming up with the idea, he'd been seeing films like Primer and Memento and things like that, and wanted to do something like that. But he's right from the start, he wanted a female protagonist, and he wanted somebody who wasn't in an interesting trade. I mean, you know, she works in a diner. She's a single mother struggling with to bring up an autistic son. And then having that kind of person as a protagonist in one of these films was a really good and interesting choice.
And they actually give her a reason for some of the things that she does too. I thought that was good.
Very much so, and it's a good female role. It's a strong female role, but it goes into some very dark places. Normally, if a big Hollywood actress had played this role, there are bits of Jess's character and bits of the arc of that they would not have played.
Yeah,
they wouldn't have taken it to those interesting and quite ugly places.
Yeah, and I think that some of the people that's in the audience watching it, mothers especially, I guess, they might identify with her a little, which is scary.
That's a possibility too. And again, we're dodging spoilers here, but I think that the emotional tone is right. And there are some things that are natural, that are part of the time loop and part of the way they set up their time loops, where you know people can repeatedly bring the same object and dump it there.
Mm.
There's another scene where there are iterations of one thing, which is really well done and interesting.
I was looking for earlier mentions of time loops in stories and films and so on. I actually found out that in the Decameron from the 14th century, there's actually a guy in there who has to catch his beloved and tear her apart every Friday. This is an interesting thing that they can actually go that far back.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice, and it shows probably how Bedacchio, who wrote it, really didn't like chicks that much.
It's very possible. I was thinking of Christopher Smith's films, Severance in the early 2000s and Black Death in 2010.
I'm getting a copy of Black Death because I really want to visit it after seeing Triangle. I want to see more of this guy. So he did another one called Creep as well. So if you see, I mean, he's got one of those horrible generic names, hasn't he?
Yeah, Chris Smith. Yeah.
Christopher Smith. But if you can see any movies that he's done, I have seen the trailer for Severance and I've seen the trailer for Black Death. But just based on having seen Triangle, I'll have a go at his stuff. And I think that he's somebody who's intelligent and really does have a passion for genre works.
Oh, absolutely. Severance is a hoot. It's a black comedy. Very, very funny. And Tim McInerney's in that. He's actually in Black Death as well, so I'm surprised he doesn't show up in this film.
Probably couldn't get him over because of the equity rules.
Probably refused to travel on a boat.
And there wasn't a really good role for him in it either, a middle-aged guy. There weren't any middle-aged guy roles particularly in the film, unless you get him in to play the cab driver role for 25 seconds.
Tim's cameo.
Yeah.
Apparently Christopher Smith's going on to do a series based on kids' book series about young adult spies called Cherub. So there's a complete reversal for him.
Yeah, but I think that he's got the job. He does action scenes very well. And I think that one of the things that I got from looking at the extras is the fact that he really cares about that meticulous planning. And they sat down with the script just before filming and tried to work out every bit that people would bitch about and complain and say it was inconsistent.
It's certainly a very meticulous film.
It is. And the only thing they've got on IMDb as a kind of goof is at one point you see an Australian PowerPoint rather than an American one. That's the only thing anybody's come up with on this film to say that something's not right. And that's great credit to the people who made it.
Apart from the fact that it generally looks like Australia and there's a car stunt in the film at some stage, and that looks very Mad Maxian.
It does. We do the best car stunts. I mean, it's a bit like I said a while back, Australians are the only people who can play the time traveller in the time machine. And we do better car stunts than anyone else.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. Hey, listen, it's somewhere to start from. You know, we work our way up from there.
And we provide the best actors in the world to go to Hollywood.
We do. You want a decent actor these days. I mean, you grab Guy Pearce and things. There's a movie he's in soon, Guy Pearce, where he's kind of playing a Snake Plissken in space.
Oh, God.
I've seen the trailer for it. And it's got good dialogue and kick-ass stuff. I'm going to have to try to find that right now because I've got it on my mind and I wanted to recommend people check out the trailer.
I think, once again, if I had to look at this film on 0G, I'd certainly give it a yeah rating. It's worth seeing.
Oh, it's very much worth seeing. It really is. It's one of those it got 81% on Rotten Tomatoes and only made $500,000 in the box office, which is really people should check this film out. I know it was at Fright Fest, and it got a good review from people in Fright Fest. But, it's just one of those films that has more to offer than you'd think by looking at the cover of the DVD.
Yeah, yet another rising British horror director.
There can never be too many. Mm. That movie I was talking about with Guy Pearce, Lockout.
Oh, yeah.
It's a French science fiction movie written by Luc Besson, amongst other people. Mm. Let's see, Lockout follows Snow by Guy Pearce, a man framed for a crime he didn't commit, who was offered his freedom in exchange for rescuing the president's daughter from an orbital prison. That looks like it might be a bit of fun. Yeah. It's got that kind of French dynamism to it. I think I'll definitely check that one out. But, yeah, getting back to Triangle, I'd recommend it too. I think if you're in Australia, if you hop down to, say, JB Hi-Fi, that you can find the Blu-ray and even the DVD pretty cheaply. And I recommend it. It's one of those kind of hidden gems in a sense. And, it's currently on cable as well. It's on Showtime, the Showtime network. And people should check that one out. So that's about it, unless you've got anything else to say about it.
No, I'm thoroughly happy with watching that. Like I said, Primer, it's in that whole zone. Primer Source Code, even, actually, thinking about it.
Yeah, it's got a lot of even though Source Code tends to go to a little bit in the Michael Bay direction with the special effects and things, I think that this one, choice of protagonist, fine acting role for Melissa George, and I think one of the things that one of the shames of this film is the fact that she didn't get more recognition for doing it. I mean, she was in the Christos Solkus miniseries here, The Slap, and it was good in that as well. I think that she's becoming one of the better actresses or actors, Australian actors who are doing films at the moment, but she's not getting much love for it because she looks like a kind of starlet kind of.
Yeah, it's a shame, but they should see this film, even just if it's just for her performance alone, but also for the fact that that Triangle has some interesting new things to ring upon the classic science fiction time loop theory, which has been in so many episodes of television shows. They all have, every science fiction and fantasy show has done a time loop story, and this one does it quite intelligently.
That's one of the things I love about it. I like people who use their brain and not just their eye. And I think that one of the other things I like about it, just the final thing I'd like to say, is I love the fact that the special effects serve the story.
Yeah, there's no fat there, is there?
No, they only had a limited effects budget, and a lot of it was done by their in-house people that they hired specifically rather than outsourcing it to a company. And I think they did well with it within that. There are some bits that do look like CGI, but that can't really be helped in this kind of a film. But in general, it serves the story really well.
Mm.
So that's about it. Rob, what have you got upcoming? What costumes are you making and things like that?
Oh, I have no idea at the moment. I'm still recovering from the Vietnam trip at the moment.
Okay.
But, you know,
Saigon, I can't believe I'm back from Saigon.
Yeah. Obviously, we've got Prometheus coming up to have a look at.
Yeah, I'm actually talking about Predator and Alien films at Continuum. Continuum Science Fiction Convention is on next weekend, the second weekend of June, and I'll be in there talking about podcasting, and we're doing that. But the interesting thing is most of the people who are going to be on that panel won't have seen Prometheus by then.
I'm seeing it Monday.
Okay, yeah, drop me a line, let me know what you think. But anyway, we'll wrap it up there because we've got an hour into it, and I'll put the feedback on the end of it, and I'll send you any feedback that we get as well, Rob.
Yeah, well, happy editing.
Thank you for that. But, thank you very much for being on Paleo Cinema. I did it. I knew I would do it. The Martian Drive-In Podcast. I do want to get you on again at some stage. I'm doing this monthly, alternating with the other one, but I might hit you up 6 months, 12 months from now.
Yeah, pleasure.
And we might do it again if you'd like to.
Yeah, it'd be fun. I've enjoyed today. A lot of fun.
Fantastic. Well, say hi to Gail for me.
I will do.
And we will catch up with you later.
Okay, no worries, Terry.
Thanks.
Bye.
And again, I'd like to thank Rob for being part of Martian Drive-In Podcast and getting me off on the guest person thing in such a good way. And Rob knows a lot about his stuff, and I really do appreciate what he brings with the Zero G and to this podcast. So I've got a bit of feedback. I'm just going to play it, and then I will talk about it because I haven't heard it yet. And I believe it is from our old friend, Dr. Zom.
Hey, Terry Frost. This is Dr. Zom. Here, I got your email and with the new phone number. You tried to throw me out the stand. Try to keep Zom from the email at the Paleo Cinema, but you can't. You cannot resist the feedback, Terry Frost. Feedback to the Paleo Cinema. Terry Frost, I watch a movie and I want to explain to you what this movie is that I watched, who the actress is, that has seeped into my soul. That movie is 1964, Mata Hari, Agent H-21, starring Jean Mahreau. Terry Frost, this is getting very difficult to do this accent for the whole feedback and the whole email, or email, this is an email, this is feedback, and this is a voicemail. So don't you try and confuse me again. I was not a fan of Jules and Jim, as I think you may know, but we covered a movie on a podcast called Silver and Gold Podcast called Querel, and in a movie called Querel, I'm throwing back into the accent, as you can possibly see, there was a madam of a certain whorehouse, and in the whorehouse, the madam would sing the song, each man keeps the things he loves, each man keeps the things he loves, da-da-da, da-da-da-da. And that actress was Jean Mahreau, who was also in the movie Jules and Jim, which I did not really care for, but I've only seen one, so maybe I should seek it out one more time so I can better judge. But seeing Jean Mahreau in Querel, each man keeps the things he loves, I like her. I like her very much. She is like a withered flower. But I came across the movie Mata Hari, 1964, starring Jean Mahreau. And in this movie, it is like again the withered flower, but much more exciting, much more sensual, much more beautiful. I will not go into the movie. I think most people know the legend of the spy, Mata Hari. But check this movie out. You will like it if you haven't seen it already. If you have seen it, I would like to hear what you think of Mata Hari. And I would like to hear what you think of the actress Jean. Anyway, sorry about being a little bit late on this this here feedback, sir. I just wanted you to know that I've been kind of doing a bunch of other crap all over the internet, doing podcasts early, doing podcast guest hosting and stuff like that. But I never forget Paleo Cinema. I never forget Teddy, Sal, Jack, and Jill, and all of my friends in Australia. And that, I don't know what that accent was. I think that was Romanian, because that was where they just did the Hatfields and McCoys with Kevin Costner, Powers Booth, and those guys. Now this is some other accent. So I don't know what's going on. I got some steaks cooking on the stove, getting ready to eat a little breakfast, and I just want to call and say, howdy, and check out those movies and, you know, some Jean Maho. I like it. I like her a lot. So this is Dr. Zom saying hi to all you Aussies, all my friends who listen to the Paleo Cinema podcast, including the Frost Giant, saying Zom. Oot. Each man keeps the things he loves. Da-da-da. Da-da-da.
Thanks for that, Zom. I'm not sure singing is particularly your forte when you're trying to be Jean Moreau. But, yeah, I like Jean Moreau. She's sexy. She's kind of intense. You got to check out The Bride Wore Black, the Truffaut film she did based on a Cornell Woolrich novel. She's a tiny bit too old for the role, but she puts it across brilliantly well. It's a dark comedy, really top stuff, and I think you'd like it, mate. Haven't seen Mata Hari, but I will check it out. I do want to get into more Jean Moreau, but you know how it is. There's so many things and so little time when you have to earn a living. But thank you for that, mate, and you're always welcome to put in your feedback at any time in whatever accent you so choose. So having said that, I'm going to finish up the second Martian Drive-In podcast. Thanks to Rob, thanks to Zom, thanks to everybody else who's put in feedback about it. We'll be back in 4 weeks' time with a third episode, and in 2 weeks' time with the next Paleo Cinema podcast. I'm going to get back into doing back-to-back films on it, whereas I've waffled for the past couple of those. But what? Enjoy your movies in the meantime. Feedback to the usual places, Facebook. You can use the voicemail line, or you can email me at kultguru@gmail.com. Listen to all of the other good podcasts. Zom himself mentioned Silver and Gold, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, The Writer and the Critic. We've got Shooting the Pooh podcast. We've got Hammockus. We have Vince, Mary, Nick, and a cast of thousands at the B-Movie Cast. And shout out to those guys, because they're all lovely. And all of the other podcasts that appear on the Paleo Cinema website. You can actually go to the Martian Drive-In blog, which is marsdrivein.blogspot.com, where I'll be putting up a few bits and pieces, including a picture of the Curiosity rover from the next Mars mission. And take care of yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time to talk about some other movie. Bye.